You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1967, at the peak of his career, Muhammad Ali, the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world, was stripped of his title and barred from the ring for claiming conscientious objector status rather than to be drafted to fight in Vietnam. For the next 3.5 years, Muhammad Ali was in exile, unable to earn a living in the ring, and shunned by the vast majority of Americans. This unexamined but highly influential chapter of the life of the great boxer is the subject of a new documentary by Oscar-nominated filmmaker Bill Siegel. The Trials of Muhammad Ali opens tomorrow at the Independent Film Center, the IFC, in Greenwich Village, and I'm very pleased to welcome Bill Siegel to our show. Hi.
Thank you very much for having me on.
For those of us of a certain age, it's startling to be reminded of just how much animus was directed toward Muhammad Ali by a majority of Americans in the mid to late 1960s, something which you reveal right from the start with an amazing interview, or whatever it was, a confrontation between David Susskind, a man I never thought was all that mean, and Muhammad Ali.
It shocked me to see that clip, and I had thought I had seen pretty much everything on Ali, but it's just yet one more reason that justified making the film. David Susskind, who I think of as, you know, on the left, attacking savagely Ali. Of course, Ali's trapped in exile on a little black and white box at that point, but that scene and the subsequent scene of former President Bush giving Ali the Medal of Freedom kind of frame the bookends of the story the film aims to tell.
And it's George W. Bush who gives him the Medal of Freedom. So there is a lot of irony there.
Lots. I'm not sure that Bush knew exactly who he was pinning the medal around in terms of all that Ali represents. And again, like you said, this forgotten or undiscovered, I think, by many generations coming of age today, period of Ali's life that, for me, makes him the legend that he is.
Well, Ali's brother, Rahman, chokes up when he discusses his brother's exile from the ring. This is many years later. The emotions are still there.
Very raw. And, I think that, again, because my sense was people hadn't gone deep into this period of Ali's life, once I started digging, people like Rahman were right there.
On the other hand, this wasn't totally a white against black thing. You have clips of Floyd Patterson, Joe Louis, Jackie Robinson, all saying that they felt Ali should serve his country.
Yeah.
I mean, Jackie Robinson, who had to have been to some degree one of the role models, one of the heroes of Muhammad Ali.
I think so. And I think for a lot of people, black people, white people, Joe Louis was a heroic figure. And then Muhammad Ali came along and turned that idea on its head. I mean, Joe Louis was contractually obligated to not gloat over his opponents, not appear in public with white women, kind of coming on the relative heels of Jack Johnson. And Muhammad Ali, said, look, I'm beautiful, I'm pretty, I'm the greatest, reckon with me because I'm not going away.
Although, interestingly, he didn't. White women were not part of the thing. He was pretty much a racial separatist for much of his life after he joined the Nation of Islam.
I think, if the film's doing its job, ultimately it's as much a story of Ali's transformation as it is our transformation in our perspective on Ali. I mean, the fact that Susskind takes him apart and then later on George Bush is giving him the Presidential Medal of Freedom to me says more about what we went through than what Ali went through.
Well, part of that transition had to do with his name. For a long time, many people refused to call him Muhammad Ali, or you show newspapers with headlines that say Clay/Ali, as though they weren't willing to go with one or the other.
It's amazing to me that I don't think the New York Times called him Muhammad Ali in print until the 70s. Bob Lipsight talks about the battles that he fought to get the paper to call him by the name that he had claimed. And
you change your name from Bill Siegel to Bill Jones
to Bob Dylan
or whatever, people would have to call you Mr. Dylan, wouldn't they?
You would think.
So why do you think there was that resistance? Was that just part of the anger toward Ali?
I think that he represented so much shock for, particularly for white people in this country, mainstream whites, who weren't ready to reckon with their heavyweight champion that they'd been accustomed to understanding how what the code of conduct was going to be, not only flaunting his victories, but changing his name, becoming a Muslim, joining a very controversial, you know, quasi-religious organization, and calling for separation of the races. That was a lot for people to take in, and that he was heavyweight champion of the world in doing it, and then Vietnam on top of that, it was just more than people could handle at that moment.
Well, was he converting to Islam or to the Nation of Islam?
He was converting to the Nation of Islam. I think that's a good distinction. And later converted to Islam.
Well, Malcolm X, when he broke with Elijah Muhammad, then talked about becoming a mainstream Muslim. And after Elijah Muhammad died, his son, Wallace, actually moved the Nation of Islam into mainstream Sunniism. But at this time, we're talking about something that really had a lot more to do with black nationalism.
True. You know, I think when Malcolm broke from the Nation, my sense is Ali was not prepared himself to follow at that time. Ultimately, you could say he did follow Malcolm's path, but via Wallace Muhammad after Elijah died.
Well, but Malcolm is the person who pretty much enlisted him into the Nation of Islam in the first place.
He's one of the people. You know, it was not where he first heard it from, about the Nation of Islam from. He'd visited Elijah Muhammad prior to meeting Malcolm X. Certainly Malcolm had a huge impact on bringing Ali in, but he wasn't alone.
Was he aware of one of the reasons for the split, that Malcolm had discovered Elijah Muhammad was sleeping with a number of the women within the Nation of Islam?
Well, Malcolm made that public, so, you know, anyone who was listening to what Malcolm was saying was aware that that was one of the reasons.
And then the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad, to some degree, was accused of being behind the assassination of Malcolm X. So how did Ali react to that?
He did, as Salim Muwakkil says in the film, decide to go with the establishment, so to speak, with Elijah Muhammad. So he was loyal, and he was a party guy, so to speak. I've heard subsequently one of the few regrets that Ali has in his life is turning his back on Malcolm. When I showed Ali a rough cut of the film last fall, he physically put his head in his hands watching Malcolm on screen. It was viscerally painful, my observation was, for him to see that.
My guest is Bill Siegel, whose film, The Trials of Muhammad Ali, will be shown at the IFC Center. It opens tomorrow, the IFC Center on 6th Avenue and, what is it, West 4th Street?
Yep, right across the street from the basketball courts.
Now, I've always wondered why Ali's decision not to go to go into the army angered so many people at a time when a lot of people were refusing to go into the military.
Well,
I mean, there were protest marches in Washington.
There were, but it was still early. You know, when Ali declared his refusal to go, you know, I mean, he refused to take the step in 67, but it was pretty clear he was headed on that path even before, you know, the day came. And so the anti-Vietnam protest movement was growing, but it was far from its peak at that point. And, you know, I think that if you think about it, Ali was really at the crosshairs of the emerging, exploding black freedom struggle and the quickly emerging anti-Vietnam War movement. And, he was early on as a public figure, earlier than Martin Luther King, for example, bringing those two together.
But you also suggest that despite the obvious intelligence of Muhammad Ali, at this time, he was still a relatively politically naive person. In fact, he was somebody who was naive about a lot of aspects of the world.
In a way, I think that, the journey that he took especially once he refused to go and was in exile and was touring college campuses, he learned a lot. He got as good as he gave. And I think that, you know,
and his speeches got better.
Yeah, they really did. You can see him evolve. You can see him become his own man and start to, you know, really move away from the Elijah Muhammad strict Nation of Islam doctrine to really thinking for himself. And that evolution only continued, as, again, did ours. I think that right alongside Ali figuring out where he is in the world, we're figuring out where we are in the world. And he is such an incredible prism through which to watch that transformation happen.
Well, I recently read a poll of different people in sports who the greatest athlete of the 20th century was, and a number said Muhammad Ali. But he went to court. Now, what were the circumstances of the court case?
So he appealed. He had filed for conscientious objector status. The government denied the claim, and he still refused to go. He was convicted of draft evasion, sentenced to 5 years in prison, fined $10,000. They took his passport away. And he appealed that through the courts all the way to the Supreme Court.
And he almost lost the case in the Supreme Court until somebody noticed a technicality.
Yeah, well, Tom Krattenmaker, a clerk for Justice Harlan at the time, I say changed the course of history because he really pushed Harlan to dig deeper into the philosophical, spiritual underpinnings of Ali's argument. Harlan did and changed his mind. Krattenmaker doesn't want to take credit himself for changing history, but I believe he did.
And then there was a whole matter of the Louisville draft board making claims that turned out to not be 100% true.
I don't know how much of the government crackdown on Ali was pointed at him and how much was standard for wanting to, you know, maintain the draft. I do think it's fair to say, you know, ultimately that he was singled out. Whether he was singled out by the government, he was definitely singled out in our consciousness. And I think for many people helped them understand why the Vietnam War was wrong.
Did Ali participate in the making of the film?
Not formally. My first step was to get his blessing. You know, I didn't need his permission per se, but I felt like if I'm going to make a film about the most notorious controversial period of Muhammad Ali's life, I want him to know, and I want him, you know, hopefully to be good with it. And he was. He and his wife met with me, and it was clear that they understood this film hadn't been made, and it was a story that needed to be told.
He also spoke with his ex-wife, who appears throughout the film. She's probably a little more militant than he is these days. But he came down with Parkinson's 1984. That's a long time ago. That's, what, 29 years ago?
Longer than that. His current wife, Lonnie Ali, is convinced that it's not boxing that is responsible for Ali's current condition. In fact, one of the things, I don't think the film doesn't really go deep into this. She was hoping it would, but if she's militant about anything, it's that it wasn't boxing. They don't really know. I talked to his doctor, and he made a clear distinction between pugilistic dementia, you know, essentially being punch drunk, and Ali. He said, you know, he's treated fighters who had pugilistic dementia, and they cannot recognize themselves in the mirror. Ali likes nothing more than to watch stuff about Ali. And I witnessed that when I showed him the rough cut. He was tracking completely. He can't verbalize, but he's there.
But he has been ill for a long time.
Yes,
we've
yes.
watched the decline of somebody who probably was the fittest looking man on earth to somebody who finds it really hard to move around.
I believe what his daughter Hannah says, that Ali is not in pain. I mean, I think for me, one of the most courageous moments in the film and in his life is 10 days after 9/11, he's on the air representing Islam at a time when, you know, Islamophobia couldn't have been any higher. Muhammad Ali said, this is not what Islam is. And he's shaking on the air. That clip is in the film. And, you know, he's never shied away from the fact that he has Parkinson's either.
One last question. Where did you find the footage of Ali's performance in Buck White, his Broadway theater appearance?
My first gig in documentary film and the original inspiration for this film was 23 years ago here in New York City in Soho, not far away, working as a researcher on Muhammad Ali, the whole story. And so my job was to immerse myself in as much material as possible. And that was one of the clips that I came across then that I knew when I returned to this film in earnest about 8 years ago had to be in the film.
Well, one of your producers, Leon Gast, made an earlier film about Muhammad Ali, but that was mostly about the boxing. This is about the private life. You don't really go into the fights other than to show us that he had a few.
Yeah, I went to the Yankees game with Leon last night. He's a dear friend, and his film, to me, will always be the master Ali documentary, but it's also an example, the prime example, in a way, of a story that starts after this film ends, largely.
The Trials of Muhammad Ali opens tomorrow at the IFC Center on 6th Avenue and West 4th Street. And I'm very pleased that Bill Siegel, its director, has been my guest today.
Thank you very much, sir.